My name's, or my handle is DCS or Decius. I'm, I guess, known for being around when things get started. I ran a bulletin board system back, it started in 91, and I wanted to get together with my friends from there in the real world, so I started a 2600 meeting in Nashville, and that turned into an Echo Mail network. How many of you know what Echo Mail is? A handful. All right. Awesome. Anybody here ran a BBS? Right on.
Ran.
With permission. So in any event, that turned into Echo Mail over the internet, which turned into a mailing list, which still exists today. I can't take credit for everything. Johnny X and Rattle here, made some very significant contributions to making this community what it is today. But we've got a mailing list at sc2600.org, and we have a conference now. It's actually a rather big thing. I was also a co-founder of Electronic Frontiers Georgia back in 1995. It became clear that the United States Congress was going to pass a law which prescribed 1 year prison sentences and $100,000 fines for essentially saying fuck on the internet in a forum that was accessible to people under the age of 18. So we decided that we needed a network to connect people, the large number of people who would be subject to investigations as a result of this, with attorneys. Fortunately, Janet Reno said she wouldn't enforce it, and it got chucked in a Supreme Court challenge. So that didn't happen, but EFGA went on to do some interesting stuff. I was also here at Dragon Con, I think in 1997, I might have that year wrong, and I did a panel with Johnny X and a local intellectual property attorney about intellectual property and the way that developing internet technology would begin to affect what we think about intellectual property. And I think that, the past, 7-8 years have borne that out with the peer-to-peer file trading and the debates over the Digital Millennium Copyright Act and a lot of that stuff. And so, Scott here has, starting with that talk, has turned this into a full track of programming with a lot of interesting information. And it's really neat to see all of this stuff here at Dragon Con. And everyone owes Scott a round of thanks for putting all of this together. So I also have like a professional career in computer security stuff, which I happen to know a thing or two about. And I also run this website, Meme Streams, which is an experiment that Rattle here and I are working on, which is about how we think electronic communities will work in the future when you have way too many idiots on the internet and you need to figure out who you really want to listen to.
That's the future?
We're trying to fix the present. But in any event, I have a few stickers up here if anyone wants one.
Or if you see me around the con, I've been carrying them. My name is Rattle. I got that because I talk way too much. Yeah. Well, hopefully I'll be talking a lot on this panel because, man, I drank way too much last night and feeling it today. So I guess what I'm mostly known for in this area is things related to SC2600. We wanted to get organized at a point in time. We just decided that we needed organization, and particularly organization that tied together all the various little chapters in the Southeast. For those of you who don't know too much about 2600, it's a magazine. But the element of it that we've usually been most concerned with are the meetings. Every first Friday of every month in cities all over the place, usually malls or coffee houses or something like that, a bunch of hackers just get together and talk. What are we doing? What are we working on? What problems are we concerned with? What issues are we facing? That kind of stuff. And we thought it would be a really great thing if we did something to facilitate more communication between those groups. Because if we did that, cool things would happen, And really, cool things did start happening. So I also work with Tom on at Industrial Memetics, working on meme streams. My specialties in that area have, most of the stuff I've contributed to has been mapping of social networks. Part of the thing that we work on is that the more accurate picture you have of your social network and the people that you get information from, the more we can build search engines and filtering systems and aggregation systems that are really tailored toward the individual. And we'll speak about that later. I always get drifting onto that topic. But it's really great to be doing these talks again. I remember the first year we did this, and it was very neat. We wound up meeting a lot of people. It wound up having positive effects. Yeah, it.
You have beer to throw at me.
Now I'm just going to take more time. No, okay. That's about it. I guess I'll take the cue there and pass it on. Drew, you want the mic?
Yeah. No, actually, I was just making fun of you. I don't really have anything else to say right now. Check. Levels.
Well, maybe
that
we
good?
Should ask okay. The audience for what they'd like to hear.
Yeah, it's usually Q&A at this point.
Yeah, so. It's the kind of audience question and answer driven, not as much as Hacking 201, but
well,
okay, first hand up right there.
There are people who say that.
Yell!
Okay, what the question that you are asking is highly politicized. So the first reference, and if you go, everyone here is familiar with Wikipedia, right? Okay, good. There's a number of articles about hacking and hacker culture in Wikipedia, and unfortunately some are better than others because there are political agendas in play there too. But
Wikipedia is /dots book report.
There's some interesting information up there. One of the things you can go find up there is the first reference to the use of the word hacking in a computer context, and that was when a bunch of guys at MIT used the local PDP-11 in order to take control of the phone system in the college and play games with it. So that sounds like, 2600-style hacking to me. And essentially, the definition was really broad in the beginning, and it really had to do with people who were interested in playing around with technology and doing creative things with it. And at the time, computers were very expensive, and you didn't really have access to them. And the idea that you would be doing something sort of creative or fun with them was highly frowned upon because other people had serious work to do with those computers, and what the hell were you doing?
They were expensive.
Yeah.
Damn it.
So in any event, what happened is this, is Eric Raymond, and I respect Eric Raymond for having written The Cathedral and the Bazaar, which I think is an important paper about open source programming, but at the same time, he also took this thing called the MIT jargon file, which was about Lisp, and it was kind of a, sort of hacker jargon file, and he turned it into this, he took it and he added a bunch of stuff, and it's, what he did is perhaps controversial, but he decided that he wanted to be called a hacker without being associated with these computer criminals that were being discussed in the news media, and so he wrote the jargon file in such a way that it attempts to draw a distinction between hackers and crackers. The reality is that in terms of so there was this other scene at the time that was sort of BBS based, which called itself the Computer Underground, which really wasn't associated with Raymond or the MIT hackers, but sort of drew from their culture in terms of what they consider their ethics and their mores and their reasons. And they refer to crackers as guys who try to break copy protection on software. So the idea of, so it's really mixed up right now. Like there's a lot of people who get into this scene and they pick up, and what you got to understand is that you can't sort of take a group of people and say, well, they're all the same. You can't look at Dragon Con and say, oh, you guys are all XYZ.
No, you're all different.
The reality is that if you look at the hacker scene, there's a broad spectrum of people. There are people there because they want to commit crimes with computers. There are people there who are not interested in doing anything with computer security at all who still consider themselves hackers.
As someone who is, let me interrupt for a sec, who's gotten many a gray hair trying to organize hacker conventions, quote unquote, the phrase herding cats is very, very accurate when trying to describe hackers as a group. They're all very individualistic and idiosyncratic, even though they all fit within a very broad demographic.
I mean, what it boils down to is people who are trying to do creative stuff with technology that's kind of outside of the established systems. You know, people who are doing stuff in their garage, people who are doing stuff at home, you know, people who aren't in academia or et cetera, you know, who are trying to do interesting stuff with technology, and that's what it boils down
to.
There's
a very strong spirit of self-education, in that every day, if you're not doing something to teach yourself something, you're not really growing. And I think there's a big element of that. And then once you've learned something and or come up with a new idea or figured out a new way to do thing, the very next thing you got to do is run and tell your friends. And that's key. And you see that in all various elements of the hacking community. If you figure out a way to break into something, you know, first line of business is do something with that information to protect people and then make sure that other people in the security field know what you did.
So there's an amount of curiosity, there's an amount of cleverness, and there's also an amount of self-promotion there. And I think that's consistent with all the hacker community. That's probably, if you had attributes, that would probably fit all of them.
So I mean, there are a lot of people who show up at the jargon file and someone tells them that that's the truth. And so they take it and they assume that that's the deal. The deal is actually quite complex. And, you know, there are a lot of very smart, very creative people who are interested in computer security specifically and think about it a lot and do potentially interesting projects with it. And, you know, you kind of have to take people at face value and look at what they're doing and decide whether or not you think it's ethical. You know, and there are certain people that you might decide aren't ethical. But, you know, there are a lot of people who are in the computer security space who are doing creative stuff who are absolutely ethical. And, you know, it's something that you need to, you know, sort of apply your head to and think about.
What was the original question?
It said the
word question
hacking.
Was about the distinction between hackers and crackers and the whole, like, the concept of hackers trying to distance themselves from people in the computer underground. And I really just don't think that, like, if you go to an underground con like DEF CON, which is quite famous, is in Las Vegas every year, they have their own, and they are very much a computer security hacker con, and they break down, you know, white hats and black hats and gray hats, where they try to assess the ethics of what people are doing and you know, have different points of view about it. So
people seem very resistive to that too, as I'd like to note. It's usually one of the things that hackers don't like to do is break everything into binary abstractions. Sounds like it's something that we'd love to do. Mm-hmm. Everything's got to be a one or zero, left or right or up or down. Doesn't really work out that way. Those systems are not complex systems. We tend to like complex systems that have a lot of growth in them. Or potential for growth, or potential for experimentation.
Now the question, a second question for the second half hour of the talk, please.
Well, yeah. One of my one last point is that the way. No. You're rude.
Get the prod out. I'll pay it.
The 5-second version.
Ethics should always be an open dialogue that doesn't end. We always need to discuss ethics.
I'm glad they're sitting at opposite ends of the table. You in the green shirt.
Can you shock them 10 times?
No. Hold on.
Identity theft has hit between 5 and 15% of Americans over the last 5 years. What does the hacker community think of this major crime?
We need better tools.
No one's going to steal your IDs if you're broke.
For identity theft.
I'm safe, but not everybody is.
We need better tools to help protect people. And by tools, I don't mean just, you know, tools you're going to run on your computer, but legal tools and procedures within the banking community to handle this. Bank of America might be a very good example for how you can both go wrong and right with the identity theft problem. When it first started occurring, Bank of America's response to most of their customers was, sorry, you know, sorry. And now they're advertising on TV that they're really going to go out there and help you with this stuff. So we need better tools, and we need to.
Real quick. Kind of,
go ahead.
All this technology is very, very young, and you know, look what we've done in the last 10 years. We've got a long way to go before this stuff matures and becomes secure. Yeah, it's just about everywhere, at least here in America these days. But it's not that secure. It's got to mature more. Document everything. Paper is still good for stuff like that. Check your stuff regularly, and it'll get better, hopefully, as time goes on.
On yourself, things like that. A lot of people watching you. You need to
We got to stop relying on a single number to identify us.
One thing I want to say is that companies that are operating things like financial systems that have built a security system for that financial system they bear financial liability if the security of that system is broken. If your credit card is stolen and somebody runs up charges, your credit card company is not going to hold you liable for those charges. They're going to take responsibility because they built the system. And the reality with identity theft was, in the beginning, nobody knew that it existed. And so if the information you were handing someone was inconsistent with what the computer told them, they tended to trust the computer. And so it's important that people understand that identity theft can happen, and they're prepared for it to happen, and they understand that when somebody is contradicting the computer, that may or may not be, they may not need to rely so much on the data that they have in there, and that's important. And I think that the reality is, in terms of the impact on individual consumers, it's something that the organizations that run these systems are taking responsibility for. They have their own insurance policies, and they're, trying to mitigate their security expenses versus how much they're paying for insurance. And it's not something that I think affects consumers directly in terms of their personal finances.
That fellow over there had a question. Yeah.
These are the same people. These are the same people, though, that double click on an XE that gets sent to them.
Watching yourself and activity in terms of your credit and whatnot is key. The sooner you catch identity theft when it's happened, the less likely it is to cause you problems. Because the people who do identity theft are not hackers. They're not hackers. They're the same scam and fraud artists that were doing, mail order schemes and stuff like that. They may have been using techniques that they've picked up that they've heard hackers talk about, but because we spend a lot of time talking about bad things, because we need to understand them. We need to know where the flaws in the system are so we can design better systems. And that is a big issue, because if we can't do that, we are all in big trouble if we can't sit around and talk about how things can go wrong. Especially in this, post-apocalyptic 9/11 age. If we can't talk about the bad things that can go wrong, we're going to see lots of them.
Who had the next question?
I just got to add one more comment to that. But
go ahead.
One of the other things about that is that we also need to, through legislation perhaps, shift some more of the burden to the people that allow the identity theft to happen through insecure systems. Because I know that a company based on a spreadsheet will only put as much money into security as they can sort of justify from a risk standpoint. So if it's more expensive for a company to let your secrets leak than it currently is, they will put more money into security, and not until then. So we need to find ways to shift the burden of the expense to the companies that don't put the money into security.
May I suggest that once someone's question has been answered, you stand up and say thank you, and we can move on to the next one. No offense to the panelists here, but we will talk your ear off, so let's make this more, if not democratic, at least mob rule.
But another way to say that, no.
I wanted to add to that. This actually,
because he hasn't said anything yet.
Tony X, recognize somebody.
Right. I wanted to add to that. As far as the blame for something like this being set onto a company, ever heard of Blackboard? They're used to, my friend Syed was running the site fuckblackboard.com. Basically, they had an extremely insecure system. Acidus actually had an article published in 2600, like 2-3 years ago. Where they had, if you were doing something like your student ID, social security number.
We don't need to go into the tech details.
Oh, okay.
There's a difference between being a criminal and having a big company, and having a big company come down on you because you simply say, hey, this is bad. And
yeah, this
in my opinion, someone who deserves the title hacker are the types of people who will say, oh, this is bad, we need to talk about this and fix this, versus the people who will go out and do evil, nasty, bad things with it.
Okay. Let's move on with the questions.
Let's move on to another question.
You go, sir.
Next.
I have an interesting wrinkle on this. Now that we live in the Enron nation, it's very easy to accuse people of computer hacking with absolutely no evidence. I work for a university that does that over and over again.
The witch! Burn!
What's that? I'm sorry? Well, I need your help, perhaps, in doing this. No, I'm talking about very serious people accused me of being a spoofer and told me to go home, get ready to be arrested, and have my computer seized. And this is a group on the size of Enron. And there's virtually no defense for something like this. I'm able to fight it, but the other people that they've accused have not. And just looking at a computer screen, they'll say that's hacking if they want to get a hold of somebody. So that's another wrinkle you might want to consider.
Okay, I think let's just go down the table on this, because I have a feeling everybody's going to have something to say. First off, we have had a lot of incidences with people we know who have gotten the hammer dropped down on them for doing the right thing. It's happened a lot. We call that group the club, and the club is getting bigger. There is one thing we need to do, and that's every time you see somebody get screwed over for doing the right thing, you stand up and you say something about it. You make sure that your opinion is present in the media stories about it. You make sure that you're telling people that guy is getting screwed for nothing, or he is getting screwed for doing the right thing. The only way you can fight bad perceptions and bad ideas is with more ideas and better ideas and better perceptions.
And the computer is the answer. I'm glad I've wandered in here. This is huge corruption and people owning the media. I've had to spend $500,000 of my own money to fight these people. We're going to be successful, but this is one of their main tools and one of their main scams.
Can you give us some key specific keywords about the situation you're talking about?
Well, Senator Charles Walker, 127 felonies.
Wait, what?
127 felony conviction of Senator Charles Walker here in Atlanta.
Okay, we will have to make a note of that. I think something like 80.
I don't know anything about the specific situation, so I can only make general comments.
I think something like 80% of the people that go into law school, like say in surveys, that they're going to do public interest law. They're going to defend, you know, people that, you know, can't necessarily afford to defend themselves. And I think something like 20% of the people that actually get out of law school end up doing that. Part of the reason is that law school is really expensive. It's like buying a house. And so when you get out, you pretty much got to whore yourself out to a large firm because you need money to pay back the massive amount of debt you've incurred. And
you're being kind to them. It's worse than that. There's sociopaths at the very head of Enron Nation.
No, that's true.
In some cases it's true, but I think it's a bad idea to badmouth the legal profession as a whole. You don't want to be on tape badmouthing the legal profession.
I'm only badmouthing the very top that are running Enron Nation.
I mean, the problem is that we have this whole system that produces these people that negotiate contracts and that fight legal issues, and they serve the people that write their paychecks. The employment contract that you get when you get a job was written by somebody who is paying to write it. Do you have a lawyer that you bring in to counter negotiate that contract before you get your job? No, you don't. It's the same thing here. If I'm a big entity and I got lots of money, I can afford a lot of counsel and I can like come down on somebody with a huge hammer. And regardless of whether or not the arguments I'm making are reasonable, you know, an individual doesn't have the resources to defend themselves. And I think it's a systemic problem in our legal system. And, you know, the solutions are not easy.
The best thing we can all do is marry a lawyer.
I think you may have a thing or two to say.
I may have a thing or two. I'm just trying to figure out what sector I want to address most directly here. It's not just the lawyers. It's also the legislators, because they're writing laws that permit, criminal activities to be brought up like this. My particular law that I was convicted under said that any unauthorized alteration of a computer was a Class C felony. Well, this is, I hand you my cell phone and you make a call. Well, that puts a little log entry in my cell phone. And if I later on can convince a DA that I didn't really authorize you to do that, which I could, maybe be angered and all of a sudden do that, that's a Class C felony, $100,000 and 5 years in jail just for that one little act. There's no limit to the size. There's no, just any unauthorized alteration of a computer. This is an insane law. the law was suggested by the phone company because they wanted to protect their assets in 1985. And we need to stop letting the legislators be so influenced by big money and big organizations that they'll write these kind of overbroad and vague laws that would give somebody 127 felonies for probably trying
to
do
it.
No,
he was the bad guy.
Oh, he was the bad guy.
No, when you say legislator, that was the head of our state senate here in Georgia who was the ultimate villain. I'm agreeing with all of what you're saying. I'm not bad-mouthing the whole legal profession, just the top percent that's running everything. When I say Enron Nation, I'm using it in shorthand. I think computers are both the answer and the problem, because you've just said how easy it is for them to write a law that anyone could be convicted under, but computers are the answer to defeating Enron-controlled media. I know I've talked very long. I want to be a part of your club, and I congratulate you on what you're doing.
Thank you.
Just consider yourself a part. That's it. We got no boundaries, walls, membership procedures, forms to fill out.
You do have to pay your dues.
Your
yes, you must donate to the Hacking 201 Beer Fund. So come on up. We got an empty cup here somewhere. No, I threw it at Rattle. Never mind.
All right, let's get another question from somebody. You right there, sir, in the greenish shirt.
Hey, you used a really broad definition of hacking that went beyond computers, and I want to ask you about the other half. I'm wondering if you have any interesting stories about mechanical or slightly electronic or even organizational hacks that have nothing to do with higher level computers that you've used either yourself or been part of an organization that did something.
One of the places where it all started, the terminology, the Model Railroad Club. Drew, talk about the Model Railroad Club instead of sitting there trying to make
Thank you very much. Yeah. The phrase hacking first appeared at MIT back in the 1950s, at least the way I recognize it anyway, and there are a lot of other people who do too. Read the book Hackers, for instance, Stephen Levy. There was a group of kids at MIT who basically they built model railroads, but being MIT, they built very, very, very complicated model railroads, and they were actually using old telephone switching circuits to link the different tracks together, switch them to make the trains run on time and hopefully not crash, although it could be fun when they did. And keep in mind that getting hold of telephone switching equipment back in the 1950s was difficult. You know, Ma Bell, Monopoly. How many of you are old enough to remember the Ma Bell Monopoly and the phone system? Yeah, okay, great. And it was about that time that the super huge mainframe computers started popping up. This was the era of the world will only need 6 computers total, blah, 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 blah. MIT had one, and the IBM priests would not let anyone near them. You wanted to submit a job to the computer. If you were important enough, you went up to the IBM priests or acolytes and gave them your punch cards or whatever, and they would get around to running them whenever and maybe tell you the results, maybe not. Oh, okay, here's the result. Oh, it fucked up. Come back later when you know what you're doing, blah, blah, blah. Wouldn't let anyone near the stuff. MIT, these are the kids who like exploring things, some of the best and brightest, and they want to learn the computer. So they would sneak in at night and play on the computer, not destructively to damage it or anything like that, just to learn how this thing worked, because there were very few computers in the world and no one had access to them. It was an interesting, fascinating, mechanical, engineering, complicated system, and they wanted to learn and understand. That was kind of the genesis of it. And when I say broader definition of hacking, my definition, and again, yours may differ, is exploring complicated systems non-destructively and learning. Phone system, hence the term phone freaks back in the 60s and 70s, again, under the Ma Bell monopoly, you had this incredibly complicated system that connected everyone in the world, or a lot of people in the world, but we had the Ma Bell monopoly here who didn't want you to know how it worked. Trust us, we're Ma Bell, you don't need to know the details. Screw that, we want to learn how it works. And you had the entire phone freaking culture spring up. There was a revival later on when cell phones first came out. Hacking seems to kind of come and go in waves. You had the BBS revolution wave, personal computers, all that sort of stuff. Pranks, a good prank is considered a hack, at least according to MIT people. And since they kind of invented all this stuff, I tend to go with them. Pranks.mit.edu is a fascinating site. Two very good books for not just computer hacking, but other systems hacking that you can get from MIT are, from Caltech, and there's another hotbed center of hacking. Caltech's Greatest Pranks, Volumes 1 and 2 from the Caltech bookstore. MIT has two books documenting their history of pranks and hacks over the years. Some of them are on the website. The exact names and ISBNs of the books are on MIT's bookstore website. I can't remember exactly what they're called right now. That's the third one that came out not too long ago. I haven't read that one yet. There are two older ones that are pretty good. Does that answer your question?
Well, let me provide you with a nice example of, perhaps what I might consider sort of institutional or organizational hacking. I asked earlier how many of you knew what Pastafarianism is. There was this, a couple more people have wandered in. There was this, there's this debate going on in Kansas about whether or not they're going to teach intelligent design in Kansas alongside the theory of evolution in science class. And so this individual wrote this letter to the Kansas, school board, indicating that a flying spaghetti monster who is invisible and made of meatballs and spaghetti controls the universe, and he had an actual picture which was sort of like a children's drawing of the creation of the universe, which involved a midget and a tree, and he talked about how the flying.
I've got all this stuff for the skepticism panels tomorrow, and we'll be displaying it for everyone to admire.
He talked about the flying spaghetti monster and da-da-da-da, and it's turned into rather a meme. There are Wikipedia pages about it, all kinds of artwork. You can get a recast of Leonardo da Vinci's paintings, with the flying spaghetti monster in them. There's a. It's a meme, it's a virus, and it's infecting people's consciousness, and it's
he used
changing
the rules that the intelligent design people were trying to use to sneak creationism in disguise into the school system and have it taught in science. He used those rules and played it better than the ID people did and made it funnier, which makes it more memorable.
And two of the board members said yes, right?
Yeah. So,
how many people know the phrase social engineering?
Yeah, I was going to.
All right. Yeah. Obviously, because I'm not intoxicated, I've completely forgot about that. So, yeah, that's probably one of the most important aspects there.
I got a social hack.
Social engineering. In fact, you could consider us to be basically practicing social engineering right now, because we're going to get you to give us money to buy beer for tomorrow night, and we didn't pay to come to this convention.
And while you're doing that, let me talk about a good social hack. Speaking of beer. Did everybody here knows that every bar is for sale? Now let me explain this. Every bar is for sale for the right price. If you learn a little bit of restaurant jargon in terms of what it takes to run a restaurant, and that you can download some pages about basic restaurant operation stuff, you can walk into any bar. Usually best if you have a buddy, so you go in like a pair. And you walk in, usually on a Thursday night, because the manager's usually there on a Thursday night, but he's not so busy that he can't talk to you. And you say, we're looking for a restaurant in the area, the bar, that we think this is a pretty good location. Just want to, chat with you for a few minutes and see if we can, if there's any interest. And of course, they'll say yes. Of course, you first ask for the manager. The manager comes over, you say yes. And usually, then you have to chat, and they usually bring out the books. And if you ask the right way, they bring out the real books. Always interesting when we get the real books brought out to us. And at this point, we still haven't shown any ID or anything. We're just two guys asking about the bar. But the great part of it is they'll usually buy you all the drinks while you're there and all your dinner. And it's a very nice thing. I actually was in the market for a restaurant. That's how I found out about this. I bought a bar in Eastern Oregon that we lost money, but that's another story. But while we were shopping around for a bar to buy, we must have had probably 50 free meals on probably 75 nights.
You said Thursday night, right?
Thursday nights work the best, yeah. But what's even better is this works for strip clubs, too. That's a social hack.
Okay, yeah. Amic, statement here, by the way. This panel comes with homework. Since we got Hacking 101 here and Hacking 201, we really want as many of you, all of you, in fact, get more people to come for the next one. But your homework assignment is to, I want everybody to have a question, at least one question designed to complete. completely stump the people on the panel here.
That's not hard.
I have an additional homework assignment. This one is very, very, very important. The signs around the Hyatt about no outside food and drink. We licked the alcohol problem last year. That's a non-issue. Getting alcohol in is trivial. The problem this year is that traditionally at Hacking 201, we take a break at midnight and order a dozen, two dozen pizzas, however much money we have and however many people are still there and want to eat. How the hell are we going to get the pizzas in here when the delivery guy pulls up right in front of the hotel? We need to figure out how we're going to get the pizzas in a timely fashion. So if you've got ideas for that, come on up and talk to us afterwards.
This...
But they charge too much.
Another thing about Hacking 201.
Eliminate the middleman.
Another thing about Hacking 201. This talk right now is your standard talk. You know, we are kind of guiding the thing along. Hacking 201. We're going to try to run that one using the unconference format. If anybody here familiar with the unconference format? Okay, I'll give a little bit of a briefer on it.
Briefly.
Basically, the unconference format is we're not giving a discussion, we're just guiding one. And the idea is to encourage people to get in discussion with each other in the room, and we'll only yank it back and steer it kind of if we have to or if we have something to interject. We're going to try to, we've run Hacking 201 like that since the beginning. Now they have a name for it. They're calling it the unconference.
Oh, there's a couple of twists since you were last at Hacking 201. We're allowed to attempt to bullshit each other, and if successful, we still give out the beer, although if someone catches us bullshitting them, then we do favors for the audience, and if we catch the audience trying to bullshit us, or someone in the audience trying to bullshit us, then we usually give them beer, but we give them one of the really, really, really bad 40-ouncers that we got, and we serve it overhand.
We had the Beast, the old Milwaukee's Best box. Yeah. That was just for the bad questions.
Who's got a question? You.
That guy.
What role do you feel open source software it should play or does play in the software market?
It pays my paycheck.
A damn important one. One of the things that's great about open source is there are certain pieces of software that might as well be considered major infrastructure pieces. Major infrastructure pieces, and they need to have a lot of eyeballs on them to basically be trustable. A good example is Bind. What would we do? Bind, Berkeley Internet Name Daemon. It's the DNS system, the thing that translates
the glue
names.
That holds the internet together.
Yeah, it is. It's the naming service of the internet, basically, the thing that runs it. There's more of a monoculture in DNS than probably any other service on the internet in terms of the tools used to do it. In fact, the people who run the root servers, which are basically this group of servers that if they went down, you're going to type in URLs and they're not going to go anywhere unless you know the IP number. They actually had to launch an effort and hire people to build a new name service daemon, not because Bind doesn't work very good, just because they don't want to have a monoculture. And by monoculture, I mean when everybody's running the same thing, you're all susceptible to the same flaws. If everybody's running Windows, a virus can take out the internet. If everybody's using Cisco routers, one Cisco router virus could take out the internet. When everybody was using Sendmail, one worm took down the internet.
We only have 3 minutes left.
That was a whole hail.
All right, fine.
I was going to say, does anyone have a question that they want anyone but Rattle to answer?
That's we could do a whole panel on that. We could do a whole panel on your question, sir. Really.
Open source software is very important. I think it's going to dominate everything in the long term, simply because how are you going to compete with it?
It'll dominate certain chunks.
There's a need. I'll make some comments. There's a need for people to, get a paycheck for working on something. But there are a lot of important open source projects like Apache, which is more than half of the web servers on the internet, that, you know, in fact are funded in one way or the other. There's a lot of value to being able to get access to source code in order to be able to change things that are getting in the way of what you need to be able to do in order to be able to you know, have a lot of eyes on pieces of software. And as much as I might not like Eric Raymond's jargon file, I do much like the Cathedral and the Bazaar, which is an essay he wrote about the value of the open source development model. You know, I think that he makes some compelling arguments for why, you know, it's got a long-term role to play, you know, in the internet.
Long-term, you'll be selling the service and support and documentation and stuff like that in pretty books and things, and not necessarily the software itself.
There's a relationship between closed and open source. We can't go all in all directions.
Thank you.
All the way in either direction.
Have we reached thank you?
Okay, one of the things I was going to say about open source is that it's really nice for troubleshooting. If you install something and something goes wrong with, like, closed source, like Windows, you're trying to figure out, okay, I know that these files might be affected by it, but with the open source, you can actually go through the source and see exactly what happened. It's much easier to trace things down with it. It makes it much easier for troubleshooting.
And even along that line, the people that produce documentation universally stink. And the nice thing about open source is if you can't figure it out from the docs, you can always go to the source and kind of peer through and try to figure out what the documentation actually was trying to say. And then write a good doc and contribute it back, exactly.
And it's easier to
improve. Or make a living selling a bonus documentation, right? Yeah.
Okay. It's it.
We have time for another question?
One last question.
You've been waiting for a while.
He's pointing at everybody.
Hi, I'm a off-the-hook listener, and I don't have the details about the specific case, but just a couple of weeks ago, I heard about someone getting arrested for using an open wireless network, and I just wanted to know your thoughts about that and what we can do about it.
I'm pretty sure the deal is that the guy was sitting outside someone's house in a van. This is a case in Florida. He was kind of hanging out outside somebody's house who happened to have an open Wi-Fi adapter, and he was sitting in his van using the guy's internet access. So it's like he kind of knew what he was doing. It's not like he was in a public place and he whipped open his laptop and there was an access point and he connected to it. He was specifically parking his car outside this guy's house. However, you know, those things are insecure out of the box, and a lot of people, you know, have open wireless networks, and I'm just afraid that the legislature is going to go in there and start creating rules because they'll probably do it wrong.
Absolutely. Yeah, and it's a real gray area too when you talk about using open wireless networks like that. Like if I'm in a public place where there's expected to be people around, like other people, like you're not parked on the side of somebody's house, I open my laptop and I see Linksys there, I have no moral qualms whatsoever about connecting to that. If I'm over somebody's house and I want to check my email and, you know, I happen to notice their neighbor has an open AP, you know, no qualms about it. But like there is an area where I think we should assume it's wrong to just co-op somebody else's network. But not across the board. I think there's a gray area.
I was wrong. I thought the panel ended at 8 for some reason, so we still have half an hour, so I guess Rattle can keep talking.
No, next question.
Somebody say thank you.
What?
Somebody say thank you.
Oh. There's a company which is marketing implantable radio frequency ID devices, as in under the skin.
Evil.
I just wondered what your reactions to that are.
Tell me where the device is and I'll disable it for you.
I'm moving to a different country, man.
That's all I'll say.
Island Dr. Moreau. Although actually, if you look at the legislation passed for Real ID, which is what most people are getting all worried about, it's very, very vague. It says electronic device. It doesn't necessarily state what specific device. There's a lot of speculation about what it could be, whether it's an RFID, whether it's just like a smart card that's, whether it's implanted in you, whether it's on a card, on a passport.
You're going to implant a smart card inside me? How?
Oh, no, what's worse, who was the guy? There's actually a guy who was a senior administrator in the Bush administration who recently got one installed. I'm trying to remember who he was. He left his post in the administration and took a position on the board of directors at the company you're talking about. And so he went and got the surgery done. And his, you know, he was, man, I don't remember the name. If you dig around on, This did make Slashdot when it happened. It was probably a month or two ago. So
it's got to be real.
No. It was corroborated by several news media outlets, which makes it less likely to be.
They were all blogs pointing at each other, though.
You know, wrong, I think. No,
I'll look it up. At this stage in time, a lot of the implant type stuff people are doing is nuts. I mean, personally, I'm waiting for the way I can, you know, wirelessly send commands with my brain to electronic devices around me and just dictate out of my head and into, like, you know, a text editor. And who knows? We may see that in 40 years. What's that? Yeah, I know they have people who can point mice and stuff, and that's awesome. I mean, that's cool. I mean, I want that.
I've always wanted a pointed mouse.
I don't want your brain waves out there floating around where they might infect stuff.
Yeah.
Tinfoil hats, maybe?
I definitely don't want something that's input. I'll tell you that much. That's scary, you know?
You will once you get it.
Okay, another
next,
question.
Next.
With you, sir, in the back there.
Wait.
Computer project and wanted to do some research for this project on the internet. So I found some websites that said that a certain form of encryption was well protected, which was a good thing, so that people with nefarious intentions could not crack it. But digging deeper, I found that other websites pointed out that it had been cracked, it was insecure, and even pointers to the code that was used to do the encryption and to crack the encryption.
Do you remember what the specific technology
was? Yeah,
what
specific?
I'd rather not elaborate on the details of the project I was working on.
Just the encryption standard.
If I talk about the encryption standard, it gives away what I'm talking about, which I'd rather not go there.
There's only about 10.
If the encryption standard you're using tells us something about the project you're talking about, then you should not be using that encryption standard.
That's not the point. The point is merely that there are different websites that said conflicting things. Okay, and so I'm curious, first of all, on the culture side, about today's culture of hacker wannabes who had the mistaken information versus the real hackers who had the real information, and also then, how does one make certain with today's internet to get the real information and not the lies?
You can't be afraid to talk to people about what you're doing in terms of the technologies that you're using, maybe what you're doing with your product or what it is you're actually building. But the reason we define standards is so that we can discuss them and basically share the flaws easier. I most of the stuff that's been around lately about encryption problems has been with the one-way hashing protocols. A few Chinese researchers have done a great job.
Excuse me, Rattler, I appreciate your point, but it's not addressing my questions.
I don't know how to address your question.
Question number one.
Yeah, I mean, how do you tell the difference between someone who's lying to you and someone who's not? You can try it yourself and see if it works. There are particular individuals who have a lot of reputation. You know, there are commentators like, you know, Bruce Schneier, for example, talks a lot about cryptography, and he's well respected. And so if you went to his weblog and he happened to be talking about the thing you're talking about, maybe you could, you know, rely on him for some perspective. One of the things that our project does is attempt to build a quantitative system in the internet that tries to rate people's reputation on certain subjects. And so you could, in theory, if you didn't know anything about one of these questions, you could potentially use this kind of technology to sort of learn who to listen to. But you know, that stuff is very sort of in its infancy. Slashdot has a system that attempts to decide whose comments are useful and whose are not. But I don't want to get into the details of how you design the different systems. You know, I don't necessarily think that they've got all the answers. But anyway,
you don't just take the first hit on Google either. I mean, the pigeons.
But
get
I obviously
wrong
kept going.
Yeah.
Well, you got it. I mean, when you're researching information, you also need to research the people that's speaking.
It's trust issue.
It to you.
Mm-hmm. The Hacker Society know who to trust and who not to. So what are good ways for newcomers?
That's a problem that exists everywhere. Like you said, how do you know when somebody's telling the truth and how do you know when they're lying? You need to do a little bit of research on the person speaking, essentially.
A lot of it is trial and error. You just need to develop a bullshit detector, essentially.
If you're asking for help for this particular instance here, I think we're all available for modest fees to do, you know, this type of research for you.
Or immodest fees.
So modest fees begin at 5 or 6 figures, I think.
Thank you.
And not counting the two after the decimal point.
My modest figure begins at 5 or 6 beers.
Beers, figures, whatever. Right now.
Next.
Question?
That guy.
Please.
No, you have to wait for the microphone.
Take a mic.
Start over.
We can't hear you.
Earlier, you were discussing the aspects of the hacking community and how that relates. And a lot of people see it as dealing with people who are either trying to get into machines or trying to do things. I deal with a lot of securities in the software realm, and most of my colleagues use it as tools to understand what things like that gentleman's problem are. If you have people who understand how to pick a lock, you can make a better lock. If you're sitting there going, well, my computer's safe, I just plugged it into the internet. Well, you have connected it to something. Even in the aspects of either the brainwave concept or dealing with Wi-Fi open hacking, when you have a network that is open, you are now taking a blindfold, unless you are watching it specifically, putting it over your eyes, and hoping somebody's not jumping on your network.
Yeah, you're right about everything.
If you have a house with no walls, don't be surprised if stuff wanders off, because people just go, hey, look, that's shiny, I want that.
This is why this aspect of hacking has to have the same sort of safe harbor for good Samaritan rules that doctors mm-hmm. have. We don't have the equivalent in the hacking community. We don't have any ability to look at things, reverse engineer them, talk about them. I mean, actually, the DMCA went the other direction with it. It got rid of free speech for DRM.
Right.
And that's insane, because now everybody will say, well, because I have DRM, I'm safe. It's insane. It took away free speech for something that really needs to be free.
Right. Open communication of this kind of information is very important. The Good Samaritan laws are easy for the myopic mind of your standard legislator. They have a very small view of their world. And it means they can't envision what's going on, what you need to do in the tech world. And if you can see that, and they can't, you have to show them how to apply that back to the Good Samaritan law. But hacking is a way to understand many things. It's gadgeteering just for tech, for computers. It's the same thing we've been doing for centuries.
Yeah.
I mean, my last name is Kossler. It derives from the German word Kessler, which is tinker. Been around for a few millennia. It's just a different twist of it and how we use it. And a lot of them don't get it.
So I think last week, or I guess this week, however you want to count it, the EFF unfortunately lost a pretty critical lawsuit. Blizzard versus BDNet. Some of you who are gamers might know a thing or two about it, but essentially somebody reverse engineered this video game and built something that was interoperable to it. I don't really understand the technical aspects, but the ultimate reality of the decision was that the sort of click wrap user license agreements that you might see when you go in and start a program for the first time can legally prevent you from reverse engineering the software and figuring out how it works. And so under this ruling, anybody can sort of put up a little notice that says, ha ha, you can't, you know, say that the emperor's naked, and you can't, and, you know, they can sue you for it. And I think that's ridiculous. I think it's very dangerous, because we cannot build this. We're becoming more and more dependent on this infrastructure all the time, and if we build it out of these naked emperors that are constructed by these organizations that don't want anyone criticizing the way that they
design
their
stuff. Why
do you
want to look at the naked emperor?
Right.
What?
I don't want to look at the naked emperor.
What are you trying to
get
away with?
But I think the naked emperor
here
should be wearing clothes.
You must be
and
a terrorist.
If I see that the emperor is naked, I'm going to say, he's naked, put some clothes on, because I have to live in this society too.
Yeah, take a look, for example, at the license you signed for Oracle. Oracle says that you can't publish a benchmark that shows them being bad or better even than anybody else. You're not allowed to publish benchmarks because you said, I'm running Oracle. And they're big enough that they can get away with that unless you discover Postgres and say, I can get rid of Oracle now.
I was just going to comment that when you set up a fortress, you always have the conflict between those trying to hold the fortress together and those trying to penetrate into it. And it's not anything that's going to go away soon. And with lockpicking, you have that. You have people who try to make a better master lock, better electromagnetic lock. And then you have the people that realize if you take the plug out of the switch, the lock becomes useless. You know? if you know how the tumblers work, you can take a torque wrench and pop it off in 5 seconds.
If you have the right kind of big pen, you can get into those. What were those? Yeah.
That or a toilet paper roll.
Or you can just kick the door over.
Yeah.
Just good enough. Right. Next.
Anyone next? Right. Next.
That guy had his hand up first, I think.
In the back.
Gentlemen, yeah.
All right, coming.
Run, Luke, run. The force is strong on this one.
Run, Forrest, run.
That's too new. It's a science fiction convention.
It's more of a comment than a question. 100 years ago, people didn't have locks in their houses. When locks started appearing on their houses, people had to, in some ways, educate themselves on how to use locks effectively to keep their possessions secured. Computer education, I think, is a big key. The generation coming up now, my son, who's very, very knowledgeable with computers, once he reaches the age as an adult, he won't have an open access point at his house. There's no way. He knows better than that. And we have to get licensed to drive cars. We don't have to have license to have children, yet the children, through abuse or neglect, can grow up and be mass murderers. Through abuse or neglect of a computer network, by going out and buying a $20 access point, you can allow your entire home network to be taken over and use it to attack a hospital, use it to attack a local government, whatever. So I think a lot of it is also computer education, and the next generation that comes up, we're not going to see the problems that we see, or not going to see the same type of problems and the openness of the problems that we see now, just literally because the next generation is way more interested and way more open to this type of technology than the previous generation was.
This is a fairly radical idea, but there are people in the computer science community who believe that proper computer literacy involves everyone knowing how to program a computer. You have a computer, everyone is going to have a computer in their house, most of them do already. The power of the computer is that you can control it, and most people don't understand how to do that. And, it's unlike, computer science is a little bit different from things like, chemical engineering. You can't build a chemical lab in your house and start producing things in bulk.
Well,
you can't. So, in any event, it depends what you're
people
doing.
People make a
but
good profit on that, too.
Yeah, there are certain professions that you really can't practically, do in your garage, but computer science is one of them. You can do almost everything with your computer at home. And there's a lot you can learn with your computer at home. A lot of the scene has to do with do-it-yourself, go in your garage and get it working and figure it out on your own. But the reality is that, the more people understand about how to use their computers in general across the board, about how to take control of the computer and make it work for them, the better off everyone's going to be. Yeah. But, I think that people are very afraid of computers, and I don't know, how willing they are to get to that depth, in sort of a broad sense across the society.
Yeah, I want to take it to a more fundamental level. It's a matter of education versus training, because if you're basically taught, this is how a computer works, this is how it works, instead of actually figuring it out for yourself, you fall into a completely different realm. Whereas your son grew up with computers, he played with them on his own, he knows how to secure the wireless network, maybe not because somebody told him how, because he went into the settings and figured it out on his own.
Sort of parallel to that and appropriate to this conference, I just read an article the other day in one of the magazines I read that has articles, apparently hiring managers are now looking at the gaming generation, that people that have been playing games, like online games, video games, but particularly online games where there's cooperation and challenges and new environments. They're finding that these people are turning out to be the best managers for innovative companies, for companies that need to make a turnaround, because they're learning not just to go status quo, rank and file. They're going, oh, we've got to figure out some way around that hill, whatever the hill happens to be or the objective happens to be for the company. So, the gaming generation is actually going to be a real interesting challenge to the next generation ahead, or behind, I should say. So that's probably appropriate in the same way. So people that know computers and gaming are going to be really hireable in the next 20 years. So keep that in mind while you're playing your 18th hour straight.
Right.
Yeah, also better shooting people.
That's right.
Well, his comment about the gaming. I'm a chemist biologist, and I got a job as a quality assurance at a flower plant. I go around with a clipboard. But I got the job, and I got a promotion to the management position because on my resume and when I was interviewed, they asked me my computer experience. And I basically just said I was a gamer. And when I just said I was a gamer, I got the job over a couple other people. And I'm a gamer outside my work. When I'm at work, that's what I like to talk about. They looked at me pretty funny. But I told them that's what I am. I'm a gamer, and that's what I do for my pastime. And so I got my promotion because of my skills through gaming. I really don't know that. I don't know how to program or anything. But it's, as your comments, they are looking for things like that. And that's how I got moving up because of my experience with games and the internet.
There you go, new challenge for everybody in here.
Who would have thought? I think that's great. But who would have thought your 8-bit Nintendo might get you that?
Donkey Kong gets you a promotion. Yeah. Dun, dun, dun,
dun. I climbed up to the top of the tower and met the boss.
That's right. left, right, up, down, up,
that,
down.
That guy a, back B, there, yeah. A, B. All the way. Who's got the microphone? That gentleman in the white shirt back all the way on the other side because we want to see you run as far as possible.
Yeah. You're a dick.
So social hacking is nothing more than learning the cheat codes.
You know, one other thing I'd also like to point out to the statement you made earlier about locks only exist.
Medic.
A piper is done.
I see blood.
Have you found that with the large advent now of open source being not only popular, but really a push in the marketplace, to have the companies like Microsoft and Sun and IBM really reevaluating their own QA from a security infrastructure in their products, more so now in the last few years that Linux especially has taken off?
IBM certainly changed.
Yeah, IBM's fully supporting open source, so they're really embracing all that. And Microsoft is on the run. And, I went to an open source convention in Brazil about 2 months ago, and there were 5,000 attendees, which for an open source convention compared to what we have in the US is like, you know, 10 times the size or 5 times the size. And they're absolutely committed to it there. And it's sometimes because of cost, but it's mostly because they can control it the way they need to, and they're not going to get that out of Microsoft.
Well, but what I was more getting at, do you see Microsoft paying more attention to fixing the security holes?
No. No, Microsoft.
They're trying to change their culture over there. They are actually trying to change their security culture over there. How much success they're going to have with that, we still, you know, it still remains to be seen. When Vista actually, you know, when we really have a chance to grind on Vista,
certainly talking about security war.
We may be able to come to some conclusions about whether the changes that they're trying to make in their security culture are working or if they're not. I hope they're working. I really do. I really dislike Microsoft, but I hope for the sake of, you know, the greater good that Microsoft does get its shit together on the security side. But it's not like anybody really does. It's not like anybody really has their shit together on the security side. It's definitely an ongoing journey.
Specifically about Microsoft, one of the other hats that I wear is I help produce computer conferences on cruise ships. And one of our recent conferences included some people that were Microsoft representatives talking about .NET. And I kind of avoided most of the actual conference part because I didn't want to be too upset during the week. But I sat in on the security talk, and they talked about how for the upcoming release, which it wasn't Vista back then, it was with Longhorn or whatever the previous name was for it, they said that, you know, every possible way that a program would want to exceed its normal privileges would be acknowledged through some dialogue. And I'm thinking, how's grandma gonna know to click okay or not okay on each one of these clicks? And they said, well, you know, we'll make the message really clear. And I'm going, so if a program wants to write into a temporary directory and it says program wants to write a temporary directory, that's clear, but not to grandma. And that's gonna be the kind of problem, you know, putting the user in control doesn't make it any more secure, but to them, they thought that was making it more secure. But worse, I said, is there gonna be a log of these things somewhere? And they said, no, there's not going to be any log because that would be insecure. And then I said, well, let's say I let my kid surf the net for an hour with my computer. And is there any way for me to tell while I'm gone what he's now allowed my computer to do? You know, not knowing what these dialog boxes are. Well, yeah, there's no log, so I guess you really wouldn't know.
Well, for one, .NET seems to be being...
Rattle, hold on a sec. I've been informed we're going to have to wrap up a little bit early, and we only have time for one more question.
I
just wanted to get that out.
Previous question.
I've been trying to dig around on the internet while we've been talking about the question that someone asked previously about
implants and chips. The company that wants to implant everyone in America with a chip is called VeriChip, V-E-R-I-C-H-I-P. And the guy from the Bush administration who got implanted was Tommy Thompson, who is the former health secretary. So I just thought I'd provide some data there.
I'm sure VeriChip could be anagrammed to something that ends in crap, right?
.NET looks like it's moving in a direction where it's going to be another one of those technologies that's used all over on the insides of corporations, but end-user applications, they don't seem to be touching .NET as much as all the pre-existing methods. I mean, I could be off base there, but that seems like the perception I've been getting. One of the things that Microsoft has never been good at, well, okay, two of the things is their stuff is never simple. It's never got that elegant simplicity, and they have no style whatsoever. I know that that's pretty much echoing what Steve Jobs usually says about them, but it's true. They have no style, and their stuff is not simple. It's just not. No elegance to it. Not that the Linux UI stuff is really all that amazing either, but...
All right, let's get one last question. There.
Yeah, you raised your hand a few times, and we missed you.
One more, right to the front.
Today you touched on both talking about banks up in their security, as well as things like chips, implants, things like that. Banks have started to care about identity theft, things like that. Don't you think it's kind of contradictory that now they're starting to roll out electronic cards that you just can swipe in front of readers and such to give your credit card information? How long before we have somebody walking around to a mall with a jacket, and inside the jacket's a freaking reader ganking every single person they pass credit card information?
Yeah, that's ridiculous.
No, you know they want to put that in your passport too. Yeah. So when you're outside the United States, I can walk around with something in my jacket that says, "Oh, he's an American. Shoot him."
Yeah. It's a complete contradiction.
Foil-wrapped passport holders.
It's just a complete contradiction. On one hand, they're up in their security, but then they're given methods to make it even easier.
Large corporations, organizations like that, very bureaucratic and hierarchical, I should drink more, in nature. It's interesting in that the left hand not only doesn't know what the right's doing, but it usually doesn't know which foot it's shooting either.
Yeah,
so that's the best analogy I can think of.
The colleges are the worst offenders, actually, in that area, and that most of the banks have at least been holding to some type of two-factor scheme. You swipe your debit card, you hit a PIN number. You swipe your credit card, you get a signature. There's at least something two-factor going on, and the signature is not really much of an authentication because they never look at the back of the card, and whatever you sign on the back of the card rubs off anyway, but that's another thing. They're at least pushing in the direction of things that remain two-factor. Biometrics is definitely going to make an appearance. The colleges are the ones who are the worst. The colleges have almost every one has some type of.
Roar!
Okay.
He doesn't mean 5 minutes for you.
The colleges always have some type of one card swipe fun thing, and it gets you in your door.
I love you,
Rattle.
You know that.
Yeah, I know. I'm going to still beat you out.
I want to know if Alonka has anything to say about RFID because she's been gone the whole time.
Yeah. Answer one question, please.
About RFIDs?
Yeah.
Yeah.
They can be useful sometimes and really suck other times.
Wow. That's profound. It's deep.